Hello, everybody. This is New Books in Psychology, and I'm your host, Eugenio Duarte, in New York. Today, we're talking about dealing with difference, why it can be so hard to connect with people who are different, and how to navigate that divide. My guests approach this topic in a novel way, by highlighting the importance of similarities and common ground, and not just differences. Their new edited book is called Psychoanalytic Perspectives on Identity and Difference, Navigating the Divide, and it covers theories about identifications and difference, as well as numerous clinical and personal anecdotes that bring this topic to life. The book is edited by my guests, who I'd like to introduce. Brent Willock is president of the Toronto Institute for Contemporary Psychoanalysis, board member of the Canadian Institute for Child and Adolescent Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy, and on the faculty of the Institute for the Advancement of Self-Psychology. Lori Bohm is supervising analyst and faculty at the William Allison White Institute and former director of their Center for Applied Psychoanalysis and Intensive Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy programs. And Rebecca Curtis is professor of psychology at Adelphi University, as well as faculty and supervisor at the William Allison White Institute and supervisor at the National Institute for the Psychotherapies. Brent, Lori, Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you, Eugenio.
So there are a lot of books and articles and even classes in diversity training that focus on recognizing and even celebrating the ways in which we're all different from one another. But in your book, you're focusing instead on the importance of recognizing similarities and shared experience. Why is this shift in focus important?
I believe that this shift in focus is very important in this day and age, because I think there's so much of an emphasis these days on how I am not like you, how we don't share sort of common. There's a loss of a notion of there being some kind of common humanity that we all share, I think, in this emphasis on difference. And I feel like it leads to such things as the kinds of policies that are going on in the United States right now, where we're trying, you know, where the government is singling out certain people for exclusion from our culture. So I think that a focus on common humanity allows us to see the ways in which we actually share wishes, hopes, dreams, desires, and so forth. And we are all actually in many ways very similar.
And I'll just add that I've done research that shows that if people are talking about how they disagree and how they're different, they like each other less than if they're talking about how they're similar and what they agree on.
I'm wondering, you know, Brent, if you can add something about whether you have any idea how we got here. Like, how did we get to a place in our training and in our ways of thinking about diversity and multiculturalism where we're so preoccupied with difference to the exclusion of similarity and sameness?
Yeah, you know, I just also, pardon me, comment that in relation to what Lori was saying, Lori actually wrote the introduction to the book, and she begins with that beautiful quotation from Harry Stack Sullivan that we are all much more simply human than otherwise. And I think that's a sentiment that pervades the book of our sense of not a denying differences, but emphasizing that we are all much more simply human than otherwise as a basis for dialogue and relationship. So now, how do we get there, you said, to this situation? I don't know that I have an answer exactly to that. Well, I suppose there's kind of a dialectical dance in identity and relatedness that is certainly emphasized in the psychoanalytic literature, where we are, as individuals, and I guess you could say as societies and cultures, constantly moving either towards an emphasis on identity and difference or relationship and grounds for commonality. Mm-hmm. And so apparently at this stage in our cultural evolution in Western societies, maybe around the world, we are a little more focused on the identity, asserting our differences, than we are on the relational aspect, if that's clear.
So then I'm thinking about the kind of training that I got in graduate school and that now that I teach, that I see still happening at the graduate level and in at many levels in higher education, where the training is definitely focused on understanding the differences, understanding the other, as people like to say. Do you all think that we're teaching diversity the wrong way, or that the way that we teach it is deficient or missing something?
I think that both approaches are important. That is, I think it's important for us to understand what makes certain cultures or each culture distinctive, and, you know, and to appreciate the fact that each human being is unique. However, I do think that there should also be in diversity training an emphasis on how we are, how we share common needs and so forth, as I said earlier.
So Laura, I want to stay with you, because in your chapter, or in the introductory chapter, you start with an anecdote that I think really sets up the question that the book sets out to then answer. And it's the story of the crusty old man who you interviewed for your dissertation. I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about him and your experience with him, and what you learned from that experience, and why you think this particular exchange that happened so long ago made such an imprint on you.
You know, I think that as a naive, that, you know, after all, I was in my 20s, and I was kind of this very sort of wide-eyed, naive, you know, optimistic person. Not that I'm not optimistic now, but, you know, you learn things in life and things change about the way you feel. But anyway, this man had, you know, seen the horrors of war, you know, World War One, and he had, you know, he'd been in the trenches. He had really, he'd had to, you know, face soldiers, you know, head on and shoot them, that kind of thing, kill people like that. And he really was tremendously affected by that experience and felt that I, as kind of a young whippersnapper, if you will, couldn't possibly understand him. That he was so very, his life experience made him, you know, just different than me. And so he really put me through like almost like, you know, an interrogation, if you will, trying to test me to find out how a person in my field, and, you know, I was a budding psychologist, could possibly walk in the shoes of, or at least understand well enough, a person who had had the kinds of life experiences he had had, in order to, you know, gain information that would be valid. So it was just very impactful, because I think that I hadn't really, you know, here was a guy who basically, if you will, looked like me. You know, he was a white guy. He was, he could have been my grandfather, you know. And it was just, it was eye-opening. And you know, we had a very earnest discussion, and he ultimately allowed himself to be interviewed. So I felt like that was a victory. On the other hand, I felt like he really left me with some important, you know, food for thought.
But what do you say? I mean, what do you say to a supervisee that you might be working with who comes in and has faces some a similar situation? Because honestly, I'm sure many do. I hear all the time of patients telling their therapist, "Well, you're not of my same race, or you're not of my same socioeconomic background, or you haven't been through what I've been through. So how could you help me?" What is that? What is that trainee supposed to say? And even how is that trainee supposed to even feel confident that he or she can be helpful to a person who's so different?
I'll share an anecdote that happened recently to me. And, you know, maybe I hope I don't sound a little bit like a broken record here, but I was at a gathering for the intensive psychoanalytic psychotherapy program at White. It was a, you know, party, beginning of the year party. And there's a young woman who's in the program who's actually from China. She grew up in China. But she came to the United States, I don't know, I think 2 years ago. I can't remember exactly what brought her here, but she is now in our program. She's in the intensive psychoanalytic psychotherapy program. And she works in Chinatown in New York, with, you know, a very disadvantaged, immigrant population there. And she was saying to me something like, You know, things are so different for them. They, you know, she was trying to make the case that it was almost like night and day, that their lives were so different that you know, than say all of us folks on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and so forth. And I said to her, and she was trying to make the case that we couldn't possibly understand. It was the same sort of case. And so I said to her, you know, think about it. I think that your patients actually have the same sorts of wishes for their children that people here have. We want our children to grow up in a healthy environment, have good food to eat, have love in their lives, have you know, the opportunity to learn in good schools. And, you know, I went on like that. And, you know, that what people want for themselves is very similar no matter where they grow up, you know, and no matter what cultural background they come from and so forth. And she was really, you know, she sort of looked at me and went, wow, you know, I'd never thought about it that way. And she was so focused on the way in which, yes, the people in Chinatown who are very disadvantaged and, you know, come from immigrant backgrounds and whatever, yes, their lives in certain ways are quite different. Their cultural practices are different and so forth. But when you get right, you know, into the depths of what people really want and need, it's the same.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, it seems, in the things that we long for.
And I say that to supervisees. You know, I say that to supervisees.
Since we're talking about a likeness and difference in the clinical situation, Rebecca, I'm wondering if you've ever encountered a situation like this, one where you've had to answer the same question for yourself. Can I really help this person whose experience I cannot really relate to?
Well, certainly. And I agree with what Laurie was saying. I was thinking about these issues before we began, though, and it occurred to me that, for example, my African-American patients had not stayed with me as long for therapy as the Caucasian ones. And I felt a little bothered by that. But, I mean, there is a lot of research that when the therapist and patients are matched on some of these dimensions, there's a better alliance and a better outcome. So I think, you know, it's wonderful if we can find a therapist that the patient feels comfortable with in many ways. And I think there's certainly much more that we have in common with any person than what we have that's different in terms of these inner longings. So I don't have anything to add, really.
Well, I'm wondering with those patients that you said stayed with you for not as long as the others, that, you know, your Black patients, you're saying typically on average stayed with you not as long as your Caucasian patients. Do you feel, looking back on those, on those patients, that the connection and the work was somehow inferior or not as strong as it was with your Caucasian patients?
No.
So then I wonder if
it might have been economics. I really can't tell you.
Yeah. Well, Brent, I want to shift gears with you for a moment now, because we've
Duhanil, just before you shift gears, could I add something
sure,
to that?
Oh, sure, of course, yeah. Stop.
I was just thinking, you had started out by saying, what would you maybe tell trainees faced with a patient from a different background who felt the trainee couldn't understand them because of a lack of commonality of experience?
Yes.
And your question made me think of Bruno Bettelheim once said that the analyst or the therapist should be very dumb. Because that way the patient will have to explain him or herself very clearly. And that comment stuck with me as as interesting, maybe important, that there is, it's also reassuring because we often are dumb or ignorant, but it would give a trainee or indeed an experienced clinician a sense that it's not necessarily a liability, but perhaps even an advantage, dumb, so that the patient has to explain themselves clearly. And because often that doesn't happen, really. We assume we know what the patient's talking about, or we assume we don't. Or something. But there's much to be said for the analyst and patient making things clear rather than assuming that they know, which can often happen, I think, even with people of very similar backgrounds, but we're all in some ways of different backgrounds, even though we're of similar backgrounds. So the analyst should be very dumb.
You know, the subtitle of your book is Navigating the Divide. And I kind of feel like what you're saying now implies that both parties have to walk and meet somewhere in the middle, that both parties involved, at least in the clinical situation, bear some kind of responsibility perhaps, or at least behooves both of them, patient as well as analyst, to make an effort to meet in the middle, because what you're placing emphasis on now is that sometimes it's helpful for the patient to explain and make him or herself clear and sort of come to the analyst a little bit, rather than only leaving it to the analyst to come to the patient. And if you don't mind, I want to push back though on this idea to see what you think, because I've heard patients sometimes complain that they're fine with explaining their lives and their cultures to their therapists, but only up to a point. They're past a certain point, they feel like they don't want to have to educate their therapist on something that a different therapist with a similar background might already know about. What do you think about that argument?
Well, the first part of your thing about how the both parties, the patient and the therapist, must have some willingness and interest in moving towards each other to find some common ground, to create some common ground. I think that's very important, and that's it fits with Bettelheim's adage. About the patients who might wish or feel it's essential that their therapist have some understanding, at least some understanding of what they're talking about. I don't know. I can certainly empathize with that feeling. I don't know if it's as necessary as that patient may think it is. That is, Bettelheim's adage may apply there, that that may be very interesting to discuss with the patient what that sentiment is like, what that feeling, that fear, that conviction is like. Has it come up already in our work together? And was that really an obstacle, or in brackets, was it an opportunity, kind of? So that we may have that conviction that, oh, those white people or those whatever people can't understand me, but it may not be as obvious and true and simple as it seems. It's just it's we can understand it, but it may not be as valid as it seems to have face validity.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add something to that, Eugenio. I think that can come from lots of different places, that kind of a wish that you don't want to be asked too much. You want to be known. And it may not just simply be a cultural or a religious or a difference kind of a thing. It may also have to do with not having been known, not having felt known as a person by the people who were supposed to really know you and care about you. For example, that's one possible outcome of the sort of inquiry that Brent is alluding to. Mm. So it would just be important to really investigate that fully, I think.
Of course, we're all psychoanalysts. So if I hear you right, you're suggesting that the wish and maybe even the insistence on being known and recognized readily through, you know, by someone of the same culture or the same background might really contain a deeper, more unconscious wish to be known in ways that are not just about culture. Am I hearing you right?
That's what I'm saying. It's you know, it's a hypothesis that a person would need, a therapist would need to keep in mind. The possibility, it obviously isn't necessarily the case,
right?
But it's one possibility,
right? You know, one of the things that I love about your book is that it covers a likeness and difference, not just in the clinical situation, but between everyday people. And Rebecca, I want to turn to you because I think you address this well in your contribution to the book. And I want to read a particular line from your chapter and have you tell us what you mean. You wrote, quote, "Simple contact with those who are different does not reduce prejudice, but intimate and cooperative situations do." And I think it's such a poignant line. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, there was this contact hypothesis started by Gordon Alport from Harvard. And it was thought that if you just had people living near each other and going to school together, that this would reduce prejudice. Now, the living together did reduce some prejudice, but overall, in terms of school integration and many other kinds, it's important. I left out one variable there, that the people be of equal status. And to reduce competition between groups or any kind of prejudice, if people work together on common goals, then that is what gets them united. And of course, there is sometimes an out group. There was a famous experiment done by Sharif at a boys' camp. And the boys were in different groups all summer, red and green, or I don't know what they were. But the only way at the end of the summer they could get them to be friendly to each other, because they had competed so much, was to get them mixed up so that the groups had members from each previous team and working on joint projects. And Elliot Aronson devised something called the jigsaw classroom, where the people in the class are mixed up in ways that they have to, each group has to contribute a piece. But it's very important for people to feel of equal status. And a good example of this, I think, was my sons went to a school called Hunter in New York. And in fact, on the chess team, we were the only parents who were both born in this country. But everyone got along so well together because everybody was concerned about the children's education. And you knew that when your child went to somebody else's house, there would be somewhat similar values to your own. The intimacy variable is also important. If people are in a therapy group, say, sharing their personal experiences so you get to know them well, that helps too.
So you said the volume focuses not so much on what keeps people apart, but on how they come together and find common ground. And you're giving us some great examples about how that happens. But what do you think are the resistances that we all have that we need to overcome in order to connect with someone who's different from us? Why do we consciously or unconsciously drag our feet?
Well, people want to maintain their view of themselves in the world. And we're seeing this right now politically. There's a lot of selective attention to sources that already agree with our position, and not enough reading and watching and being exposed to positions that are different. And I think that there was a Nobel Prize winner named Bohm in physics. He talked about dialogues. I think it's really important for people sometimes to play devil's advocate and take the other position and see what evidence there is for it.
But are you suggesting
I think
go ahead.
People should definitely not just look at the media that they know is going to agree with them.
But there must be some vulnerability then that we have to be willing to experience in order to do that, don't you think?
Definitely. An openness to experience is one of the five personality traits that's a part of what is known as the Big Five. And most people don't really want to change.
You know, Eugenio, I have a thought about your question from that actually there are a few chapters in our book that I think speak to what I'm about to say. There's a chapter in the book having to do with the struggle in Australia for the Aboriginal people to be allowed to have their own culture and so forth within the country. The country wanted to basically I think the same thing happened with the Maori in New Zealand, and there's a chapter about that as well. But basically, I think that people want to feel like it certainly includes what Rebecca was saying, want to maintain their sense of themselves and they don't want to change and so forth. But there's also, I think, a struggle that people have to feel like they are somehow good enough or even better than the other person. And so one of the ways that I think people think about themselves as better than is that they look at very superficial things like the color of a person's skin or the way in which they, you know, get their food or the way in which they live or, you know, things like that. Maybe their religion. They look at superficial things and they see themselves as better than because they have X while the other person has Y, and Y is considered less than X. And I think there's a very strong need on the part of people to feel better than, and then they measure it in these ways that are kind of not important, you know.
But do you think that desire to be better than, do you think that that's a conscious desire that some people have, or do you think that's something that's unconscious?
I think it can be both. I think for some people it's quite conscious, you know. I think, think about how things work in our society. We have a very competitive culture, don't we? You know, if you look at sports, even sports, you know, people are constantly trying to be the best at whatever it is. You know, they're ranked in school, whatever. So I think there's a focus on trying to be the best. And, perhaps people who don't succeed in those areas have to find other ways to see themselves as better than.
I think that that's a particularly Western point of view. I've just been reading a book on cross-cultural psychology. And, you know, certainly in Asian cultures, there is more of a desire to fit in and not stand out. And many times people want to feel like they're like everyone else and not different.
Brent, I want to bring you in because in your chapter, you give us an idea about how this happens on a deeper psychoanalytic level. And in particular, you talk about the mechanisms of projection and identification and how they're at play when one person mistreats or rejects or attacks another who's different. So, you know, for our listeners who don't speak psychoanalysis, I'm wondering if you can explain how these processes work and describe what you mean by what you call the do or done to dynamic.
Sure, Eugenio, I'll try to do that. Maybe I can begin by just giving a simple vignette from a clinical interaction, and I think that might get us into those concepts. This had to do with a middle-aged woman that I've been treating for some time, and she came to a session saying very upset, saying that her teenage niece was going to come and visit her for a few days. And my patient said, "Well, what's in it for me? Someone else should shoulder this responsibility. Damn it, this is the last time I'll ever sacrifice a weekend for my sister's daughter." She was quite riled up. And I was a little bit taken aback in that my sense was that she really liked this young girl, and rather regretted that the vast geographical distance separating them prevented them having a natural evolving relationship as much as she would have liked. So ordinarily she would have looked forward to this visit and seen it as a chance to bond and have a good time. And I said that to her, that that was my impression of her general attitude towards this niece. And I was puzzled by why she was so put out, put off by this upcoming visit. And she agreed with my observation, but she said, regardless, she's just in no mood to see this niece. And so I wondered to her if her antipathy might reflect something of how she believed her own mother, my patient's mother, felt towards her when she was a child, namely that she was a unwanted burden. And as soon as I said that, that made sense. It seemed to maybe have a calming influence, an organizing influence for my patient. And she said, yeah, that's it. I'm playing the roles, she said, of my child self, the burdensome niece, and of my mother, the irritable woman who doesn't want to be bothered with this youngster. So that's the at least the beginning of the vignette of one of the ones I talk about in this book. So in terms of those psychological or psychoanalytic terms you mentioned, Eugenio, identification and so forth, what I see going on here is my patient, who I call Lorraine, she is she's reliving something of her relationship with her mother that she carries with her well into middle age. And she has, as a way of sort of surviving that, she has identified with her mother. So that's the identification with the aggressor. Better to be the rejecting mother than to be the rejected kid. And so that's the identification. So she, as a child, in a way, she ceased to be herself. She identified more with the dismissive mother. And so there's an identification with the aggressor and a disidentification with the self. She ceases to be her vulnerable, needy, loving child self. And the third technical term I put in there, which is common in psychoanalysis, is projective identification. She projects that unbearable sense of herself as being unwanted into her niece on this occasion. So her niece is the unwanted, burdensome child. So have those three things going on: identification with the aggressor, disidentification with the self, and projective identification into the niece. So then, maybe just to fast forward to the next session or two, after the niece's visit, Lorraine comes to me and she says, well, you know, it was a totally different than I expected. I had forgotten that the last time my niece came, her mother had been suffering from cancer and her niece was out of sorts. And so there would have been tough issues in the air. But this time that wasn't the case. And the weekend had been wonderful. And particularly she shared an instance where one evening her niece was watching some teenage television program. And my patient Lorraine's, oh, brother, and she goes off to her own computer to do something that's interesting and not deadly boring to her. And then she's up at her computer being alone, as she so often is, and saying, wait a minute, maybe I should go and watch that program with my niece. It might be interesting. And so she goes down and she does. And indeed, it is a lovely experience. And my patient, Lorraine, she said, this was a holy grail weekend, meaning that, oh, my God, my mother never would have watched a TV program with me. And I so much would have loved that if she had. And here I was having that experience with my niece of an adult and a child enjoying being together and enjoying the content, even if it isn't their favorite cup of tea, but for the adult, but having a good time. So it was a Holy Grail weekend. So in these vignettes, my patient is beginning to undo all those defensive mechanisms, the identification with the aggressor, the disidentification with herself, and the projective identification into the niece. She's beginning to undo that with the help of the therapy, and it gets her to Holy Grail place. So that's... those maybe cumbersome intellectual terms, how they apply in a sort of ordinary clinical moment.
Well, and thankfully Lorraine had your help in breaking out of these cycles, but on a day-to-day level, and for people who are not in psychotherapy or who wouldn't think to bring up their everyday interactions in their therapy, how do we break out of these cycles? And do you think that these are cycles that we get into on a day-to-day level with strangers that we interact with on the street or at the store or in traffic or on the train? And how do we break out of that?
Well, I'm sure it does happen outside of therapy, but therapy or analysis are great ways of facilitating it and making it more likely to happen and to happen more quickly. I suppose it involves getting a third position from which to view the situation. In therapy, the therapist provides that. Lorraine is tied up in her mind with herself and her burdensome niece and how awful this weekend is going to be. And so I, as therapist in this case, provide an outside perspective that's able to reformulate in a way that proves useful to the patient. If we're on our own, sometimes we have a friend we talk to, and the friends or the bartender serves that role of being the third and providing that third perspective that can have a transforming effect if we're lucky. So finding someone else, or if we don't have someone else like a friend to talk that over with, then maybe in our mind some sort of third position pops up that to maybe where we've seen something like this happen in a play or on television or something. I think you need some sort of third position to help get you out of the dyadic stuckness. And therapists are good at that, but surely friends can do the same thing if one's lucky enough to have such a friend. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I want to move from the everyday to some more extreme situations that illustrate this phenomenon in a different way. And I want to talk about a chapter in your book written by Dr. Sue Kolod entitled "Reluctance to Finding Oneself in the Other, Treating an Alleged Pedophile." So this is obviously an extreme instance of difference because Dr. Kolod is working with an older man who's been accused of sexually abusing his granddaughter, which makes it very challenging for Dr. Kolod to find the kind of common ground and identification that your book is encouraging us to strive for. Can one of you tell us a little bit about this case, and in particular, how in the world Dr. Kolod managed to connect with this patient and what you think about it?
Yeah. That chapter interested me, you know, because I myself had worked with a man who did not deny that he had abused his daughter. And so I had some kindred experience to Dr. Kolod. In her case, the man she was working with said he had never done any such thing, but he had been taken out of his home by the police in handcuffs, incarcerated, files opened on him with Child Protective Services. He lost his job. So he was rather traumatized. But Dr. Kolod felt uncomfortable in him, I guess felt a divide, navigable or unnavigable, in relation to him, because she was wondering, did he do it? And Of course, there's no way of knowing, but he was, the patient was very persistently determined to try and convince her that he hadn't done it. And I'm sure his arguments were good, but in the end, you can never know. Only he, I guess, can know. And the girl involved who had recanted her testimony against him. But what are those recantings? They're sometimes not not true. So Dr. Claude was troubled by that factor between them. Initially, her patient had wanted her, and his lawyer had wanted her to give an opinion to the court and to the Child Protection Services saying he had not done it, or he was not the sort of person to fit the profile of those who would do this. And she declined to do that, but agreed to do the therapy, and they went ahead. At some point, I guess she was troubled by this issue of did he or didn't he, she took a rather unusual step of contacting a pedophile and an acknowledged pedophile who was an author. He wrote books on in praise of pedophilia, kind of, and one on Michael Jackson and issues in Michael's life. And so she contacted him, and her chapter contains some of their email correspondence. And I guess perhaps even as I say that, maybe our listeners are wondering, wow, that's interesting. What's going to happen in this dialogue? And her chapter shows what did happen. But it's she tells the author pedophile right up front that, look, you and I are never going to agree on the acceptability of pedophilia. And I don't even want to go there, but what I want to talk to you about is this concern I have with my patient. It struck me in her saying that she was sort of right up front saying there's a unnavigable divide between me and you, Mr. Author. I think his name was O'Connor. There's an unnavigable divide. I do not believe in adults having sexual relations with children, and you do, and ne'er we twain shall meet on this one. And he accepts that premise for their continuing to talk to each other, and they do. And they have a useful dialogue, at the end of which she comes out feeling it's no longer a block between her and her patient. She can work with him on the basis of what she's learned from this author. One thing, and she does, and they work quite well together, and though she never does know whether he did or didn't do this thing with his granddaughter, but the man's life is going better. He's over his PTSD, his depression. He's got slightly more access to his granddaughter than he had before, and all. So things are on a good path. And one thing that I thought that I don't think Dr. Colod mentions, but I wondered if in turning to the actual pedophile, her patient was a possible pedophile, but this author was a proud pedophile, and that in going to him, maybe she was navigating a divide where she was having a conversation with someone she probably normally would not have a conversation.
Definitely.
Yeah, and they have a very intelligent, mutually respectful conversation that's useful, certainly to Dr. Collot, and at least the author says he's very pleased at the opportunity to talk with her, and he seems to be. And so I think she kind of went into the lion's den, you might say, and navigated the divide, overcame, let's say, phobia or not phobia, but some reluctance to getting to know the other. And she really took the bull by the horns, sort of went in there and got to see that this fellow was pretty interesting, intelligent, feelingful human being, whatever his other thoughts are that she didn't get to know with him particularly, mm-hmm. although she knew that. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's maybe in addition to all that Dr. Collard says that's so interesting in her chapter, that may be an additional thing of how she's navigating the divide.
I just want to add one little thing to this, which is that, and I completely agree with you, Brent. I think that's a great point. What Dr. Collard was trying to write about was the importance of finding oneself in the other, mm-hmm. within our patients, in order to be able to identify with them and to be able to help them. And I suppose that is an answer, Eugenio, to your earlier question of how do you help a supervisee? You know, the supervisee needs to be able to find themselves in some way and the other. And perhaps one of the things that happened for Dr. Collard is that she could relate to this guy who was the author, who was the pedophile, and she could find herself a little bit in him, even though he was so, his views on what you can do with children were so radically different than hers. But she found a point of contact, and then she was subsequently able to find herself, if you will, in her patient as well, and that helped her to help him.
That's a very important point, and I think whatever the patient's problem is, we have to be able to identify in ourselves that same aspect. Even if the patient, I haven't ever had a murderer or a prostitute, I have had a couple of those, but we all have these disconnected, not me parts of ourselves. And if we can find in ourselves a part that wouldn't act on these impulses, but might be able to recognize them, I think it's very helpful.
Well, you know, and in the clinical situation, it's clear that as therapists, it behooves us to find ourselves in the patient because we're there to help the patient. And this seems to prove that finding oneself in the other eventually does help the treatment. But I'm wondering, once again, outside of the consulting room and in our everyday lives, and I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment here, why should we go through this trouble to find ourselves in other people who are different? What's in it for us? Does this enrich our lives in some way, or is it just a lot of work?
It's definitely enriching to find out about things that we don't know about.
Lori, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I agree with you, Rebecca. I think it's definitely enriching. I'm a person who enjoys traveling very much. And I find it, you know, stimulating on all kinds of levels to travel. But one of the things that I especially like is the opportunity to actually interact with people, you know, all over, you know, places in the world that I, you know, have never been to and whose cultures are very different and so forth. And to have the opportunity to actually sit down with them and have a conversation and, you know, see how they do things, how do they deal with their children? How do they, you know, what's important to them? What do they value? Stuff like that. I find it very exciting and very enriching. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know in daily life, you know, why is this a good idea? I mean, it seems to me that there are myriad reasons for it to be a good idea. And it isn't just to enrich the self. It's also, you know, to create a more collaborative place for ourselves to live, you know?
So we have a kind of social responsibility, maybe, in addition to doing this for ourselves.
Absolutely. Yes.
And what about for you, Brent? I mean, do you find either in your work or outside your work, when you're applying these ideas, when you're trying to find that piece of yourself in the other who's different, does it change you? Does it do something for the spirit, for the soul?
Yeah, it sure does. Lori was perhaps saying this, that, yeah, and getting to know these different people or cultures we can learn better ways of being the kind of being with ourselves, with our partners, with our kids. We can learn things that they do better. I was thinking, I was thrown back sort of autobiographically when Lori was talking to a time in my childhood when, here's true confessions, a neighbor had physical disabilities and I must have said something to mock him. And my mother said, he would like to be just like we are, to have the physical abilities and capacities of speech and everything. And I'm sure I felt guilty and humiliated, but not so much. More, I felt enlightened by, oh yeah, of course, that I'd seen him as other and different and undoubtedly threatening, so I was being devaluing. And it was a transformative moment to be told that he is much more similar than different. He has the same wishes and longings and hopes and fears as we do. Maybe, you know, I was lucky. I got educated early on that. Donald Trump, I guess, maybe is being taught that possibly in his 70s. But I lucked out there and was enriched by that.
I'm glad for that. And I'm so glad that I've had a chance to talk to the three of you. It's been a really enlightening conversation. I think that your book is such an important and timely contribution to the literature. Before we go, you want to each tell me what you're working on these days?
Just finished a book of case studies and commentaries. The case studies are interpersonal, relational ones. Brent and Lori and I have a book on passion that is about finished. Those are some things.
How about you, Lori?
One of the things that I've been very excited about being involved in is we're trying to launch at the White Institute a public mental health think tank or a public mental health project to try to address some of the issues that are going on in our world today that are problematic. And one of the things we're doing is trying to develop a dialogue project that will bring people, what we'll do hopefully is be able to bring people together who are on different sides of the political divide, if you will, about a particular issue and have them, you know, facilitate a dialogue between them to try to get them to at least understand where the other person is coming from and see some ways in which they're, you know, along these themes more similar than they think they are. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very exciting.
Wow. How about you, Brent?
Yes, thank you, Eugenio. Lori and Rebecca and I have been working, this is perhaps maybe something like our sixth book that we're working on now, this one on passion. So we've had the pleasure of working together and creating and actually seeing some results of some fruits of our labors. So that's been good and an ongoing thing that we're doing. Myself, I'm working on a book about some very disturbed people, one being a Canadian Air Force, a commander of Canada's largest Air Force base who, after hours, would break into people's homes and steal, do things with women's underwear, make all kinds of videos, ultimately progressing to rape and murder and... So there's someone who's where presents a certain issue of difference in spades, and I guess without having probably thought of it in terms of this current book we're talking about here today on identity and difference, it's my effort to understand something about him and to try to communicate that understanding to hopefully a readership. Yeah, so. I guess I'm working on some things that very much do pertain to the topic of today's discussion.
Well, those all sound like very exciting and maybe even challenging, but worthwhile projects. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Brent, Lori, Rebecca, and I hope that you'll come back again when the next book comes out.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting us.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
It was a real pleasure, Eugenio. Thank you.
Absolutely. Pleasure was mine. That was my interview with Brent Willock, Lori Balm, and Rebecca Coleman Curtis, editors of the book Psychoanalytic Perspectives on Identity and Difference, Navigating the Divide. I'd love to hear your feedback, so go to my website, www.eugenioduartephd.com, and click on the blog and podcast tab to find this episode and leave me a comment. Have a great week.